You've got a headache, and I've got some strange disease. Don't worry about it. This pill will set your mind at ease. It's called Progenitorivox. It's made by Squab Merle Co. It's a life-enhancing miracle, but there are some things you should know.
It may cause agitation, palpitations, excessive salivation, constipation, male lactation, rust-colored urination, hallucinations, bad vibrations, mild electric shock sensations, but it's worth it for the drugs I need.
Hi, this is Robert Reister, and you are listening to Steady Health Radio on BBS Radio Channel 1. Welcome. Thank you for coming back. Thank you for visiting us for the first time. Steady Health Radio is a show about the things you need to know about health that you aren't going to find out from your doctors. We try to be evidence-based, we try to be honest, we try to be factual, but we don't necessarily buy into a pharmaceutical model, we don't necessarily buy into a mainstream model, and as you might have guessed from the intro, we don't necessarily believe that you have to buy a pill to fix it. Before I get too far into my show, even though this is the second week of the show, there's some people I'd like to thank. First of all, my list is Elizabeth, who I want to identify more than that, other than to say that without Elizabeth's health, this health and help, this show would not be. Also, I'd like to give a shout out to my producer, Doug Newsom, who's absolutely the best in the business. I've been on hundreds of radio shows, and you just don't get better than Doug. Over the years, I've been helped by Udo Palmer, Mark Blumenthal, Rudy Schuer, Phyllis Balch, Dimitrio Sotopoulos, Norman Goldfein, Clee Irwin, and most recently by Tanya Todich. I'd like to say a few words about Tanya before I get too far into my show. Tanya is an editor for a website called steadyhealth.com. In fact, I'd encourage you to log on to steadyhealth.com because we have some great new articles this week on 10 topics that are in the news. Tanya approached me, I guess it was 4 years ago, about writing for her site. And she said that she wanted original articles. She wanted articles on topics that you couldn't just get on Google and look up. And sure enough, she gave me assignments starting just 10 a month, I think it was, on topics that I had never heard of. But I actually had to go out and talk to people who had dealt with these problems or had treated these problems to come up with the topics that we have on the site. Well, I'm just one of five writers for the site, but Tanya Todich and her collaborators have created a place for 285,000 people to get answers to health questions. I'm probably the least credentialed writer for the site. I'm the only one who isn't an MD or a PhD. I'm just someone who has a background in chemistry and has done a lot of work in the nutritional supplements business. But we will answer any question that comes to us the best we can. We do our best to be honest. We never charge for information. We don't create a doctor-patient relationship, but you can't. If you can't find what you want to find on steadyhealth.com, chances are you're not going to find it anywhere else. A lot of you know that I have been speaking on my experiences with life, afterlife, and near death. And a lot of you know that I have a very different experience from what you see in a lot of the books. I've read a book by Dr. Eben Alexander called Proof of Heaven. He talks about having these fantastic experiences while his brain was dead. And I've read a delightful book, Dying to Be Me, by Anita Mordani, in which she talks about her experiences of being near death from cancer and coming back to life when she came to know her true spiritual purpose in the spirit world. What I'd like to talk with you today about is my own experiences in this line, but mine aren't so flashy. I can't really prove heaven from what I've experienced. I'm sorry. I can't disprove heaven either, but I can certainly tell you a lot about what there is in the experience of dying and dealing with death and being forewarned of death that can lighten up your life if you know how to handle it. a lot of my understanding of death actually comes from my interactions with my father. I don't remember this, obviously, but I'm told that when I was a baby, I was a breech birth. And my mother had a long, long labor, and I came out, and I wasn't breathing. I was blue. The doctor pronounced me dead, wrote out a death certificate instead of a birth certificate, and went home. My father just wouldn't accept that. And as I was told many years later, my dad stood over my body and said, "Cry, damn it, cry." And I did. I woke up. I came to life. And my mother and father got the hell out of that hospital just as fast as they possibly could. And the very next day, they took me to church to make sure that I was sanctified and squared away with God, because this was I was actually their fourth child. I was going to be the child that lived, and sure enough, I did. Well, I was 18 years old. I was growing up in Texas, where you have these bodies of water called stock tanks. And they're great for swimming, but sometimes they have some hidden hazards. Well, I was swimming in this stock tank, and my foot got caught on something, still don't know what, and I got stuck in the water, and I drowned. My father happened to be on the side of the stock tank, maybe 30, 40 yards away. He dashes in, grabs my foot, resuscitates me after I've lost consciousness and I've gone to this otherworldly place. But there's Dad. He gives me a mouth-to-mouth, he drains out my lungs, and we don't even go to the doctor. Well, we go maybe 30 years past that. Well, 25 years past that. My father has a widowmaker heart attack. And at that time, widowmaker heart attacks were always fatal. And we do know for sure that he died at least four times in an ambulance getting to the hospital, which was 45 miles away. He didn't talk about that. He was very much a changed man of whatever happened. But he simply didn't talk about it. My dad was from the World War II era. He had been in combat in the South Pacific with the Marines. People like that just didn't talk about spiritual experiences and angels and demons and tunnels. And they were just alive or not. Well, about a year and a half after that, my mother was dying of cancer. And she had been in what looked like a coma until just a few hours before she died, and she motioned to us to put her in her wheelchair. She motioned to us to take her to the living room. And lo and behold, my brother and his children, my mother's grandchildren, had come to see her. And she perked up for this. Somehow she knew they were coming. We don't know how she knew they were coming. As far as I know, my brother didn't call ahead. But my mother knew that she was going to have a last visit with my brother, my sister-in-law, my niece, my nephew. And then she motioned for us to take her back to her bed. My brother and I did. And my brother took the kids home, and my father and I stood by her bed. And she motioned to us to stay put. Don't go anywhere. And so we stayed put. We weren't going to go anywhere. But she was very, very close to death. And about an hour before she actually died, my father and I were standing by the opposite sides of the bed, and we saw a bright light. We heard people that my mother was very close to who had passed away already, greeting her to wherever this place was. And we had this intense, enormous feeling of joy. And I looked to my father, and I said, "Do you see this?" He says, "Yes, son. Of course I do." Like it was the most normal thing in the world. Well, my mother didn't actually stop breathing for another hour, and she passed away. And 10 years go by. My father is at the end of his journey, and supposedly he wasn't able to speak to anyone. He was supposedly comatose. I went to see him anyway. He sits up. He looks great. He says, "Son, have I been a good daddy?" I said, "Dad, you've been a great daddy." And he says, "Oh, now you got to deal with all this stuff yourself. Bye, son." And it didn't even register on me that he was about to die. But when I got home, well, a little after I got home, I got a actually it was a knock on the window because I didn't hear the door. And a family member was coming by to tell me my dad was dead. Well, that was kind of odd. And I went about my life, and if there was any one thing I was sure of is that as a natural health expert, I was certainly not going to have atherosclerosis, and I certainly was not going to have a Widowmaker heart attack. And I had tests that showed that my arteries were open and clean and functional for many, many years, and there was absolutely no reason to believe I would have a heart attack. Well, sure enough, I had a Widowmaker heart attack. And I get into the hospital, and the doctor says, well, we can't operate. There's really not a whole lot to be done for you. I said, well, gee, thanks. And I don't know whether it was morphine or stress or what was going on, but they put me up in my hospital bed, and I'm not Catholic. But the Virgin Mary comes to me and it says, hi, I'm Mary. No. Mother of God and all that. Virgin Mary is very, very relaxed, and I've told with other people who've had apparitions of the Virgin Mary that she's anything but threatening. They thought it was real. Anyway, I'm sitting there, you know, I'm not Catholic. I sort of believe you historically existed, but what's going on? I said, well, I'm just going to explain how the universe works to you. I said, okay. I'm in a hospital bed with a Widowmaker heart attack. I may or may not live, and the Virgin Mary is explaining to me how the universe works. Okay. And it was really a beautiful experience. She explained how all the religions were partially right and partially wrong, how it didn't really make any difference, how she, among many other persons, was always with us. Should I go off and become a Catholic? She says, oh, no, you're going to live in my house. I thought, oh, no, I'm going to die. I'm going to go wherever this Virgin Mary is. But it turns out that I spent a little while in a Catholic comfort house that was dedicated to the Virgin Mary. I had never heard of it. Certainly, I had no plans of going there. But I did get out of the hospital, and I was discharged to this place for a few weeks. Well, I still hadn't had any treatment for my heart. I was still probably going to die in a few weeks. And I eventually went to a hospital that said, what on earth have they been telling you these other places? You need to have heart surgery, and you need to have it right now. Actually, I didn't get it for about 48 hours. It took them that long to stabilize me. But I had my heart operation. And then the surgeon says, well, your arteries are in such horrible shape that you've really got to have another procedure, but you can have it this week. So I have another procedure. Well, if you have two heart surgeries in 2 days, you don't get up too quickly. So I was in the hospital 3 weeks later, and I was lying in my bed, and lo and behold, my father appears. Just as vivid, either vividly, if you're speaking colloquially, or floridly, as the psychiatrist would describe hallucination. I saw my father as he looked like when he was 35 years old and I was a little kid. And my dad says, it's going to be all right, son. I said, well, thank you, Dad. Are you real? And my father says, ha-ha, I certainly think so, son. It sounded just like it did when the day he died. Anyway, my dad vanishes. Then the next night, I look to the side of my bed, and lo and behold, there's my mother, looking radiant, looking beautiful, wearing her favorite dress, looking like she was about 35 years old. And she says, it's going to be all right. And this time I didn't even ask her, are you real? I said, thank you. And she vanishes. Well, I'm still in the hospital the next night. And a crowd of people shows up. And it's not communicated in words. It's communicated in some kind of immediacy. Where this crowd of people in my hospital room says, it's going to be all right. They're going to send you out, but you're going to come back. And then it's going to all be right. I thought, going to all be right. Now, what does that mean? Anyway, the next day I was discharged. I wasn't supposed to be discharged. I was just was discharged. I didn't have my wallet, didn't have my cell phone. My friends didn't know I was out. I had exactly $1 in change. I had nothing to eat. I had no medications. I didn't have a coat. It was cold. It was November. And despite all this, the hospital says, you've got to go now. And I tried to just hang out in the lobby, and the security guard chased me out and put me on a at a bus stop and had me spend my own dollar for a trip downtown. This was in Austin, Texas, in October of last year. And I thought, well, I'm a member of a church, and they're going to be open in 12 hours. So I'll just hang out around this downtown church, and maybe I won't get mugged for the money I don't have. And I'll at least have a cup of coffee in the morning and see what can be arranged. While I got to church, I had my cup of coffee. I went through all the normal routine that you would go through, except for the fact maybe most people would shower and shave before they go. Most men would shower and shave before they go to church. I sit through the service. I really enjoy it. I keel over. What I didn't know is that an artery 5 millimeters away from my heart had burst. And anyway, I was lying there, and they called 911. They sent me right back to the hospital from which I'd been discharged the day before. The surgeon comes in and says, well, we got to do another operation. I said, well, that's no big surprise. So another 2 days passes before they've got a surgical center open. And I have the operation. It's a success, they say. They put me back in my room. My mother, my father, and all of these throngs of people in kind of a spiritual form all show up and say, it's almost time. I said, okay, almost time for what? And a few seconds later or a few minutes later, I don't really know, they said, it's almost time. And then a little bit later, they said, my mother, or at least what I perceive to have been my mother, says, here it is. And I feel my heart stop. I feel my breathing stop. I go swoosh off to join all these people. At the exact moment that two nurses from my floor, a visiting nurse, and a student all come in to my room, at the exact moment I go into cardiac arrest. And they start working on me. They're trained to do this. They know what to do. And it just happened that another surgeon was walking by my room in the hallway when this happens. Well, they give me epinephrine, and they give me atropine, and they give me CPR. And they, next thing I know, my mother says, you're not going to be with us very long here. You've got to go back. It wasn't a choice. Can you go back? Will you go back? Do you want to go back? You're going back. And I wake up on the gurney, and this Dr. Vinagoni is saying to me, Dr. Vinagoni's from Italy. He says, do you know where you are? I said, sì, in ospedale. I don't speak Italian. And he says, do you know your name? I said, sì, io sono Roberto Rister. And he says, can you count to five? He says, he's talking in Italian. I said, sì, uno, due, tre, quattro, and the thought comes to my mind, ooh, I seem to have gone back into the wrong body. And I stopped breathing. Apparently, when you stop breathing, you have enough oxygen in your system to keep you conscious for a while. Anyway, I got through the end of the hall, down an elevator, and I was being taken into an operating room, I die again. Well, the next thing I know, I'm in this horrible, hideous, black place. It's the blackest black you can possibly imagine, except it's even blacker than that. It's not just the absence of color and sound and contact. It's just total isolation. It's the place that people describe as hell. And I'm in this place. I'm there is nobody else with me. There is no comforting presence. But I hear something. I hear 360. No detectable pulse. Shall we call it? And about that time, my eyes open. And I didn't have the energy to say, no, I'm not dead. Don't send me to the funeral home quite yet. But the next thing I know, the cardiac surgeon is leaning over me and he says, I don't have time to give you anesthesia. This is going to hurt. And he takes out his scalpel and opens an artery, puts a balloon in my heart, and then he operates for 2.5 hours without anesthesia, which is kind of a memorable experience, actually. Well, all of this happens, and they get me in an ICU, and they say, it's amazing you live. It's amazing your brain seems to be working. Obviously, I had the very best, the very brightest, the greatest medical technology. And somehow I managed to come back from the dead. And depending on how you want to count it, either 2 or 3 times that day and maybe 4 times earlier in my life, including a couple of events I didn't mention today. What I found in that time is that not a whole lot changed. I still had hundreds of thousands of dollars of medical bills that my insurance was not going to pay. I still needed a job. I still needed a place to live. I still needed food to eat. But I found that every single day since that incident, no matter what I do, it's almost like I can't screw up. Life is going to be good. Life is going to be satisfying. I'm certainly not worried about dying. I'm not in a hurry for it. But I'm not going to go to any elaborate lengths to avoid it. But I found that since this time, I just know that I'm in contact with the rest of the world. I'm in contact with the people I love, the people that love me. But I'm also very much involved in this world. Now, I'm going to open up phone lines just in case somebody wants to call. You can reach us on Skype at BBS Radio. You can call us toll-free from North America at 888-627-6006. Or you can call us toll-free from anywhere in the world at your country code for United States, 530-327-7602. And I'd welcome any questions anyone would like to make, or comments or corrections, or tell us about your own experience. That would be great. But while I'm waiting for your calls, I want to tell you a little bit about how I think what happened to me happens. I personally still, even though I've had these apparitions of the Virgin Mary and talked to my dead parents and gone to this place where you go when you're not breathing and your heart isn't beating, I still don't believe in the supernatural. I only believe that there are natural events that we don't understand. I do think that some of the theories of quantum physics and some of the discoveries of brain science are really interesting. And because I'm not a quantum physicist and I'm not a neurologist or a brain surgeon, I may be wrong about the science, but I'm going to tell you what I think happens anyway. There's a principle in physics that has been proven maybe 30 years ago called Bell's theorem. And it says that whenever two particles come in contact, they stay in contact. They stay able to influence each other forever. This means if two subatomic particles come in contact and the experimenter can separate them by a distance of 7 miles and they seem to still be in communication with each other. I don't really understand the physics, but it seems to make a kind of sense. And if this Big Bang theory is true, that the whole universe sprang from a single particle some billions of years ago, then everything in the whole universe is in contact all the time. Well, our brains are an interesting agglomeration of cells called neurons. There are between 10 billion and 100 billion neurons in our brains. And every one of those neurons makes at least 10,000 connections, in children maybe 15,000 connections to other neurons. And every one of those connections to other neurons vibrates 1,000 times a second. it only takes 60 neurons to have as many connections as there are subatomic particles in the universe. Actually, he's not a physicist. He's a commentator on social ethics named David Brooks says. So just a small, small fraction of the neurons in our brain can have as many connections as there are particles in the entire universe. Actually, we have 10 billion times more neurons than we need to have as many connections as there are particles in the whole universe. Well, every one of our neurons, it turns out, has 10 million tubules made of proteins that change in their configuration in tiny ways, to change electric fields in very tiny ways, 10 billion times a second. So every one of the 100 billion neurons is connected to 10,000 other neurons that it communicates with 1,000 times a second, has 10 million tubules that vibrate 10 billion times a second. It's as if we were in contact with everything that is and was and ever shall be in our brains all the time. Well, obviously we're not aware of that, but maybe that's what happens when we go through these near-death experiences. When your heart stops, an ME told me, your brain stops about 13 seconds later. And I've looked into the literature that says maybe your brain stops 6 seconds later, maybe your brain stops 15 seconds later, but you lose consciousness. That doesn't mean that your brain cells are dead. It just means your brain stops functioning. But these individual neurons continue to do their thing for up to 8 hours. It's as if the flame in a furnace goes out, but the pilot light is still on. So for up to 8 hours, the neurons continue to function, but they don't talk to each other. So for the people who are in what we call near-death or actual death experiences, the neurons stop being so totally bombarded with information that maybe they can notice what is important. Maybe they can notice the connections that are primordial, that are closest to us. Now, in my case, obviously my connections to my parents were very important. There are connections to other people that are very important. And in my experience of actual death, I had a grand old time visiting with them, but it wasn't just people who were dead. There are people who are close to me who are alive that I also managed to contact during this experience. So, well, that's really kind of odd. Now, what's going on? I don't know, but it was a really wonderful experience. And while people talk about everybody having a life review or a judgment, I didn't experience that at all. It's as if everybody in that scenario already knew everything about my life, including me. There was no need for a life review. My life had already been reviewed. It was not going to be accepted or rejected. There was no way to accept or reject anything you've done because there is no past, no present, no future in this other place. There is no time. There is no space. So there is no punishment, and there actually is no forgiveness either. But there's no – everything that is simply is. I'm going to ask my producer to continue to take calls from 888-627-6008 in the United States and Canada and to give me a 2-minute break, and I'll be right back. Thanks for coming back to Steady Health Radio. I'm Robert Reister. We're still getting a few of the kinks out of production, figuring out how we connect to various networks, how we get some assurance that the people that want to listen to the show can actually hear us. I've been talking about near-death experiences and the reasons why our attitudes toward death make such a big difference in how we go about our health. A lot of the things we do to keep steady health are really about avoiding death, and some of them get to be, I think, kind of silly. My favorite example is particularly someone who's survived 3 heart attacks, 4 strokes, 3 brain aneurysms, a coronary artery aneurysm, and 20 bouts with ischemic colitis. I can tell you that statin drugs do not prevent these things. Nonetheless, I do the crazy thing that a lot of people do. I take a statin drug too. I'm not really sure why I do that, except for the fact that there have been some studies that found that if you have a 1.5% chance of getting a heart attack in a given year, if you don't take a statin drug, you have a 1% chance of having a heart attack in a given year if you do take a statin drug. Well, I've already had 3, so it's not like I'm going to miss out on my first, second, or third heart attack or my first, second, or third cardiac arrest. I'm still here, and I don't really think it was the statin drug that did it. I do think it was great medical intervention if I had my cardiac arrest any place other than in a cardiology ward with a cardiac surgeon walking by my door. I don't know how those would have turned out, but I had a near-death experience when I was a baby, and it was my father shouting at me that seemed to bring me back. I drowned when I was 18 years old, and it was again my father who pulled me out of a stock tank and gave me his resuscitation. I had 2 other incidents in the early 2000s in which I just keeled over, my heart stopped, and in one case, a friend gave me a thump in the chest that seemed to restart me. Nonetheless, despite the fact that I really don't think that taking Crestor does anything at all for me, I find myself doing that. I don't know why people stick to the little things that we can do that make a difference, but that is what a lot of medicine is about, and to be honest with you, a lot of alternative medicine is about. We do what we can. It's maybe it's a kind of act of defiance against death that we do the crazy things our doctors ask, and we go out and get our supplements. And we go online and we read medical literature and we read articles by people like me who attempt to explain what's going on. But I think basically what everybody needs to know at a fundamental level, because every one of you out there will go through what I have been through in the last year. Every single one of you listening to me will eventually suffer a cardiac arrest. Your brains will die. And I'm not quite sure where you will go or how you will experience what you experience after death. But I'm telling you what I did. And I believe that even if we are just in contact with the rest of this timeless, eternal space for a millisecond at the very, very end of our lives, just before our brains turn into mush, I still think it's just as good as if we had a trip to the traditional heaven where there seems to be a history, where there seems to be a fixed place out there somewhere where you have to go. But what I'm telling you is that it comes to you. You don't have to go to it. And I'm certainly not going to tell you not to do things that your religion tells you to do, because religions tend to have good ethical content. But I am going to tell you that in my case, it wasn't me. I did have a kind of vision or hallucination or I had a really great imagination if it was imagination. And if it was hallucination, it was amazing how well my brain was operating. But the first time I had a Widowmaker heart attack, I was lying in bed. I was having the Virgin Mary. And as I mentioned, I'm not a Catholic. the Virgin Mary explaining how the universe worked to me. It's okay. This is great. So that explains the Christian religion. I don't comprehend it all. It's just, you don't have to. God comes to you, which is actually also in the aspect of the Christian religion with which I identify most closely, that is kind of a teaching that God comes to you, God has chosen you. There's not much you can do about it because God is invincible. God is great. God is God alone. Of course, I have friends who don't believe in God at all, and I don't think God is at all offended. If you go to this place where everything is connected, we don't see God because we are humans. We are limited. We may have our prophecies and our revelations, but I don't know about you, but I've never seen God in all of this. However, if you go to this other place where everything's connected, well, then you don't see God because you're so connected to all of God's creation, you can't see God. So all I can say about the definition of God is I can't define God. I'm not an atheist. I'm not really a theist anymore. I don't reject the existence of God, but I don't find a need for God because God has already filled it. I know some of you will disagree with that, and some of you, I will get at least 30 or 40 letters from people telling me I'm going to hell, that's where I really went, that's where I'm going to stay. That's fine. I guess you'll see, we'll see. I don't think that the ultimate being is so small and so needy that the Almighty needs the defense of us humans in our human form. I believe that the Almighty can reach us where we are, when we are, that the Almighty is already there. But our source that we come from and go back to, well, maybe we can't tap into that source while we're alive. Maybe that source expects us to do things on our own while we're alive. But I do know that we rejoin that source, at least in my case, when we die. And if it is just for a millisecond or a microsecond or a nanosecond at the end of life, it's just as real as if it were, as humans understand, eternity. But have you ever thought about all the things we do to avoid the experience of death because we're afraid of it? Doctors used to get all bent out of shape when their patients died, as if they had failed. And now doctors tend to find ways to blame their patients when their patients die, as if it's the patient's fault. I don't think either approach is healthy. I don't think either approach leads to steady health or health in a meaningful way. In the United States, we spend, depending on the estimate, between 20 and 40% of all our Medicare dollars taking care of people in the last month of their lives. It's not as vast amount of money as you might think. It's more like $35,000 per person that we spend trying to keep people alive for just a few more days to keep them from dying. Well, as someone who actually had a $155,000 bill for being resuscitated, I can tell you that the amount of money we spend in end-of-life care isn't going to cover it if it actually works. The $155,000 I had for the afternoon in the catheter lab getting resuscitated is a whole lot more than the $35,000 average Medicare spends. But on the other hand, if it comes to that point again, do I want my fellow Americans to pay their taxes so I can be resuscitated? Well, yeah, actually I do. I actually want all of you guys to chip in and pay for my resuscitation. I'm selfish about that, but at least I'm fair. And I would say that we should be doing that, but man, we really need to think about keeping people on ventilators. We really need to think again about chemotherapy and radiation therapy and all the things we do to keep death away for another day, another week, another month. I'm not sure that – well, I am sure that it's not worth it if you can obtain a quality of life without going through the motions of fearing death. If you can find things that keep you plugged in and alive and connected to living people in the here and now, I think that is much superior to investments in avoiding death. I don't know exactly what it is we need to know as society to make wise and ethical decisions for other people. I would encourage all of you to express your wishes on these kinds of matters ahead of time in end-of-life documents, whatever that may be in your jurisdiction. At some point on steadyhealth.com, I'm sure that we will cover this issue. And I apologize for extending my conversation here. I'm looking at some of our messages. And, oh, by the way, I do have some questions coming in about the steadyhealth.com site. We don't just talk about matters of life and death at steadyhealth.com. In fact, although I've written maybe 15 or 20 articles on this sort of thing, and you can find me on steadyhealth.com over Robert Reister, R-I-S-T-E-R. It's misspelled German. There are thousands of articles on all kinds of health topics. And this particular week, we are covering a few things that just don't have anything at all to do with life, death, and afterlife. For instance, there is an article this week on Facebook affective disorder. It's a up-and-coming psychiatric diagnosis. It's not yet into the DSM-5, about people who can't stop logging into Facebook. And if you go to steadyhealth.com, you'll find a banner of various articles for this week, and one of them will be on the Facebook affective disorder that tells you what to do if you or someone you know and love simply can't quit logging into Facebook, particularly if there's someone who logs in the middle of the night and has to get up and check on the status of their friends, or someone who has to post about the same thing 50 or 100 times a day. I don't know if any of your friends are like that, but a few of mine are. I love them anyway. This week on Facebook.com, on SteadyHealth.com, we're also talking about cyclospora. There is a potential epidemic of a protozoal disease going around the United States this week. It's kind of a nasty little bug. It's an animal. It's not a bacterium. And it's picked up from soil that's contaminated with feces. Someone releases himself on the ground, and then that dirt gets on a vegetable, particularly if it gets on a sticky vegetable, like, say, a raspberry. It's usually raspberries that cause these epidemics. You wouldn't see this in the news quite yet, but my guess is imported raspberries are causing the epidemic this time. The protozoan sticks on the berries, and you can't kill it with Clorox. You can't kill it with the disinfectants you buy in the grocery store for produce. This is a really tough little bug because it becomes a cyst. And when you eat that cyst on infected raspberries or lettuce, the acid in your stomach breaks it open. So it goes into your small intestine where it meets another protozoan that's been liberated by the acid in your stomach, and they have sex. The parasite reproduces in the human intestinal tract and makes people pretty sick. At the very least, you would have awful gastrointestinal symptoms for a while and can get in children and in older people, it can be really quite serious. So personally, what I would do is if I'm going to eat the raspberries until the epidemic is over, make sure they're frozen. Freezing kills the parasite and the cyst. A cooking kills the parasite and the cyst. It's the fresh raspberries that are imported from places where there are problems with sanitation that are usually the problem. The other problem produce, and this is also something that isn't in the news quite yet, is that mesclun, mixed greens, you know, the little red lettuces and leaf lettuces and dandelions you find in packages. Usually those are perfectly fine. It's the ones that you would find out in the bin that may or may not be a problem. Don't be paranoid if you've been eating that. Just I would leave it alone for a while, at least until there's a first frost in the lettuce producing areas. That frost will kill the parasite. Another article we have in statehealth.com this week is summer love. I guess we try to be kind of like one of the magazines you see in the supermarket, the checkout line. We do have 10 tests of summer love this week. We also have a variety of articles on just about anything you would like to see. And if you would like to send in a question to steadyhealth.com, join up. There's no cost. We'll never try to sell you anything. We'd love to have your questions. And either I or some better qualified expert would probably answer your questions at length. Like I say, we can't create a doctor-patient relationship just because you log into our site, but we will do everything we can to give you information that you can't get anywhere else, including referrals to physicians who can provide specialized services that you can't get, and including referrals for even pharmaceutical medications that you may need and can't afford. Now, next week, I will have an expert speak on one of the most controversial topics in natural health today, and that's fracking. Fracking is the process of injecting water and chemicals into rock to release natural gas and oil. My expert next week will be Dr. Dennis Schneider, who is not your average fracker. For one thing, he's a scuba diving enthusiast who spends a lot of his personal time finding ways to save whales and dolphins. And in his professional life, Dr. Schneider has developed a really interesting way of fracking an oil well. He does it with bacteria. He's taken the bacteria that grow in geysers and in rocks, cultured them, found ways to produce mass quantities of them, and instead of injecting an oil well with some kind of fracking chemical, he injects them with bacteria. The bacteria eat waxes. Dr. Schneider can better explain this than I. I understand some of them can consume hydrogen sulfide, that nasty, stinky, rotten egg gas that is poisonous, that comes out of wells. So next week, my guest will be someone who talks about organic fracking and just how natural the process of fracking an oil well can be. 2 weeks from now, I'll be interviewing an expert in the health of horses. I'll have an expert on who develops nutritional supplements for horses. I'm sure that some of you have favorite relationship with your favorite horse. We'll be glad to tune into that. We'll talk about what works, what doesn't work, the least expensive and possibly the most expensive ways to take care of your horse naturally. And in future weeks, we'll be talking about cancer. We'll be talking about heart disease. We'll always have an open line ready for those who want to talk about spiritual experiences. You don't have to just listen to my spiritual experience. You're welcome to listen to someone else's and to share your own on the radio, although I hope you don't mind if we ask you difficult questions from time to time. We, on Steady Health Radio, we may not actually always come up with the truth because we're limited and we make mistakes, but we certainly make every effort to be evidence-based on our show. We make every effort to be helpful on our show. We don't try to take anyone away from anything that works for them. Certainly would never, ever try to interfere with your relationship with your doctor or to get you to stop taking a pharmaceutical drug. I own this show, so I can tell you we will never be dependent on advertising from anyone who's selling a nutritional supplement. I may actually offer links from the steadyhealthradio.com site to some of my guests, but simply because they have a good product out there. But this is a non-commercial show. We don't have to have advertising. We don't owe anyone anything except to you to tell the truth as best we can. I hope that you'll tune in next week on BBS Radio 1, and I hope that you'll take a look at my site at steadyhealthradio.com. Welcome comments and questions. And even better, log into steadyhealth.com for the best articles on practical steady health that you can find on the internet. Please join steadyhealth.com and become one of the 285,000 members that share their experiences with others, learn from other members on the site, and keep us experts on the toes. So until next week, thank you for listening to Steady Health Radio. I'm Robert Reister, signing off. Listen.